Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. We are the only radio show that supplies free legal goo, and here it is for you. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, so please do remember that, okay? Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, my darling little true crime angels, if you get all upset about something you hear on this radio show, you don't take it out on the forums or the people on the forums. You come to yours truly, Trisha, and we'll make you all happy again. Now, my unofficial official co-host, Michael from Minnesota, is not here tonight. He's dealing with a very bad headache, and we're going to miss him. Now, I think Michael in Minnesota gets these headaches because he has to talk with that thick Minnesota accent, you know, Minnesota. And that hurts your head after a while. Yeah, it does. It's a Minnesota. I mean, it's just, I feel bad for him. He has to talk like that. He gets bad headaches. Not like out here in Utah, where I live, where we say everything right. Like, oh my flippin' heck, for sure. Poor Michael. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. He'll be back with us next week. Our guest tonight, long overdue, Robert, we call him Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. And Bob takes a very in-depth look into the victims of the Long Island serial killer, finds out about their lives, found out more than anybody else has so far as to why they chose this life for themselves. You are going to be surprised to find out all of the things. I mean, we can't tell everything tonight. You have to buy the book, for goodness sakes. But Bob is going to just thrill you with the stuff he has found. I'm telling you, it is beyond fascinating. And I know we have a lot of Long Island serial killer members from Web Sleuths on here tonight. So why don't you call in, talk to Bob, join in. I mean, you know as much as anybody. And Bob will tell you all about how he went to Web Sleuths for some of his information. So it was quite a wonderful working relationship. 760-825-0933. That's 760-825-0933 if you'd like to talk to Bob Kolker. And Bob, welcome again. This interview is long overdue. My apologies for taking so long, but I'm going to make it up to you tonight. You can talk as long as you want. You can say whatever you want. You can swear. We'll go on for 3 hours, and it's all yours, okay? We'll make you feel good.
Thanks, Trisha.
Hey,
I'll try to be more succinct than 3 hours, but thank you. It's a thrill to be on the show.
We could go on for 5 or 10 hours, that's for sure. Now, for sure. See, that's what we say in Utah, for sure. Anyway, Bob, the Long Island serial killer case, a lot of the people listening are very familiar with it, and then there's a lot of people who don't know anything about it other than the title. So why don't you, so we can start this out correctly, give us an overview of the case, kind of a succinct Reader's Digest version, if you will, of the Long Island serial killer case.
Sure. It's very nice and a little intimidating to be on a show where I know that some of the listeners have been paying, you know, as much attention to the case as I have, or even more. And so I'll just extend my apologies if I gloss over something that other listeners might think is important. But the book I wrote, Lost Girls, is meant to bring attention to this unsolved case and also meant to humanize some of the people involved in it who really have become sort of cardboard cartoon characters in much of the media coverage. It's a case about a serial killer still at large on Long Island, and it's also a case about why the victims were so vulnerable in the first place. It talks about their lives, not just their jobs as internet escorts, but also their entire lives and why they came to that decision. But the story really begins about 3.5 years ago in the spring of 2010 when a woman named Shannon Gilbert disappeared in a small oceanfront community called Oak Beach on the barrier islands of Long Island. Now, for your listeners who don't know about this part of Long Island, this is a part that, while it's in the middle of a megalopolis of 11 million people, is actually a little very remote place that takes at least 20 minutes by car to get even a quart of milk or to get to the supermarket or the pharmacy. It's really, people who live there like to be alone, and they like to be a big fish in a small pond, and they don't really like their lives interfered with. But this one morning about 3.5 years ago, Shannon Gilbert went screaming down the street, knocking on doors, screaming help. And several neighbors saw her, several neighbors called 911, but by the time police arrived, she was gone. At the time, The case didn't get any attention. The press didn't really cover it. And the police didn't even treat it as a missing persons case because they had nothing to go on when they showed up. And it's, mm-hmm. A lot of people suspect that the community did their best to try to keep things quiet as well. They didn't offer up their security video that ended up not being provided to police. Yeah, they figured, well, maybe she was just having a squabble with someone and ended up going home with them. The only thing that police knew and neighbors knew at the time, obviously, was that Shannon was an escort and was visiting a John, a neighbor in their community, a guy named Joe Brewer. Now, there are a lot of folks on Web Sleuths and off of Web Sleuths who suspect that neighbors knew more about what happened to Shannon and just wouldn't tell the police. And I get into those theories in the book, but I'll just stay in time here and talk about what's known at the time. So
okay.
That was in May, 3.5 years ago in 2010. Spring turns to summer. Summer turns to fall. Shannon never emerges again. Her family wants to know where she is. Her boyfriend wants to know where she is. They all file a missing persons report. Shannon lives a good distance away in Jersey City, New Jersey, which really is at least an hour and a half, 2 hour drive from Oak Beach, Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in another state. And so the police eventually do get that missing persons report, but it's months later. They go, they do a bit of canvassing of the community, but again, it's months later. And as anyone who follows criminal justice knows, the trail's very cold by then.
Sure.
But there is a police officer who continues to search for Shannon. He's doing it as a training exercise. He's part of a cadaver dog unit. And he and his dog go searching when it's time to train, and he likes using open cases to do it. And then one day in December of 2010, so we're still about 3 years ago, he's about 3 miles away from Oak Beach. Technically, it's called Gilgo Beach at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, on these remote barrier islands, and it's off the side of a highway that runs through the barrier islands. He's out there, and the dog finds a set of human remains. He assumes or wonders if it's Shannon, but it isn't. He knows this immediately because Shannon had a defining feature. She had a piece of titanium in her jaw from an assault that she endured several years earlier. In order to patch herself up, she got titanium in her jaw. And so they know immediately, looking at the remains, that this isn't Shannon. And they continue to search. And a tenth of a mile away, they find another set of remains. And then a tenth of a mile away from there, roughly, another set. And in all, they find 4 sets of remains over 3 days.
Wow.
All with burlap around them. The reports say that they are bound or shrouded in burlap.
Mm-hmm.
And the all intact skeletons, stripped down of any flesh, apparently, but intact skeletons. And so this is a... And again, they're all more or less the same distance away from one another on a desolate stretch of highway in Long Island. The assumption here immediately from police is that this is the work of one killer, that it's has a lot of intention behind it, a method, and a great deal of care going into the disposal of these bodies. And so the media descends immediately. And one of the first things that the Suffolk County Police in Long Island say is that they believe that these bodies are the bodies of escorts who advertised on Craigslist, because they are assuming that this case and the Shannon Gilbert case are related. Now, keep in
sure.
mind, Shannon still has not been discovered. And
these
so,
other bodies are discovered first, and it was Shannon they were looking for all along, and they haven't discovered her at this point.
Exactly. We're in December 2010 now, and it's getting colder, and there's going to be snow soon. And so they divide up the side of the highway into quadrants. They get lots of volunteers who have to go look. But within a few weeks, the snows come, and they have to put off their search. And at this point, most people assume that they're going to find the killer immediately. I think it's safe to say that most people assume this. I know I did at the time. I'm a reporter for New York Magazine,
sure.
and I write about crime stories, among other stories. And I actually resisted writing about this story at first because I thought by the time I got in the car and went out to Long Island, they would have found the killer. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I thought this is, at the time it felt obvious because it had only been a short period since Philip Haynes Markoff, the Craigslist killer, had been apprehended up in Boston. And for those listeners who don't know much about that case, this is a guy who answered a Craigslist ad for massage and killed the masseuse and was caught within a day because he had a digital trail. And, you know, we all watch the same TV shows and Criminal Minds or SVU or CSI, and right. You think, well, four victims, four computer trails, they're going to catch him four times as quickly. But it didn't happen that way. He was not caught. And in January, the victims were identified. Four women, all very much like Shannon, women in their 20s who came from towns far away from New York City and who advertised on Craigslist and Backpage and other places on the internet to make mm-hmm. money. There's Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who disappeared a very long time before she was eventually found, way back in 2007. Her family had been looking for her for 3 years. She was last seen in Penn Station in Manhattan. And there was Melissa Bartholomew, who had been seen in the Bronx, last seen in the Bronx in 2009. She came from Buffalo, New York, and had been living in New York City for a couple of years. I can tell you more about her life, but she had quite an ordeal as a street-walking escort with a pimp until she finally mm-hmm. turned to Craigslist. And there's Megan Waterman, who was from Scarborough, Maine, and Portland, Maine. She was last seen leaving a hotel in Long Island just a month after Shannon's disappearance in 2010. She had disappeared in May of 2000, or no, early June of 2010. And, you know, she had been coming in for short trips to Long Island to work on Craigslist. She had a boyfriend with her who has since been apprehended and accused of human trafficking by taking her over state lines. And yet it doesn't seem that he's suspected of playing any sort of role in her murder.
Okay.
And there's Amber Lynn Costello, who disappeared, the most recent of the victims. She was disappeared in September of 2010. She was last seen leaving a house in West Babylon, not far from, probably the closest to the beach. And she had a very sad story, Amber. She grew up in North Carolina, and she had been living in Long Island and really had descended into drug addiction and was working out of her home and had several friends with her who all were also descending into addiction together. I get into this into the book. She had her closest relationship most likely was with her older sister, Kim, who I interview extensively. Kim was also for a very long time in her life an escort. And so she offers perhaps the most detailed view of what that life is like and why people make that decision and how hard it is to get out of that life once you're in it.
Right. And Bob, I want to stop you for a moment. We're talking with Bob Kolker. He's the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, and it's about the victims in the Long Island serial killer case, although you do get into the actual details of the case as well. And what I want our listeners to understand about this book that Bob wrote is nobody has been able to get to the victims' families and friends like Bob has. You're going to find the most in-depth background reporting, and you'll find it absolutely fascinating how the internet has changed the way prostitutes work and how many more people are going into prostitution because of the internet. So not only do you get the case with Bob's book, but you also get the background. And all of them have tragic backgrounds, obviously, or they wouldn't be where they were at. But it is a fascinating human study of how people fall and go down into the depths of despair. So anyway, Bob, I'm sorry. I just wanted to get that in there so people knew exactly what your book was about.
Sure. And I would add to that, just from a true crime enthusiast perspective, I think anyone listening understands that most serial killer victims are women like this, mm-hmm. women who are vulnerable because they work as escorts and they work in the shadows. They work the killer, as Joel Rifkin once said very explicitly, he says they have no family and no one will miss them. They become the perfect victims. What's interesting about these victims is that they did have families and that their families did miss them, and that it was often law enforcement that was turning a blind eye to their disappearances and not following up the way that they might have if the victims had been in a different line of work. And that's when Lost Girls and when this case in general really becomes a story about class, and about how we investigate in some things and not investigate others. The families in this case talk about Natalie Holloway, for instance, and they say, you know, if their daughters or sisters had been a little richer and a little blonder, that maybe their disappearances would have been taken more seriously, would have been on cable news all the time. So really, I write about five women and their families and how their murders really ripped apart the families, and but also brought all of the families together online through Facebook at first and then face-to-face. And then it's a weird irony that it's the computer that these women use for work, it's the internet they use for work, and now it's the internet that brings their families together as well. And then the internet brings web sleuths together as well to try to solve the case. And that's a big part of this book also.
And you do talk about web sleuths. I'm sorry, but please continue. You have much more to say than I do, so please go on.
Well, I'm excited. I was excited in this book, and I when I first started out, I wasn't sure if I'd be able to find a home for it in the book, but I'm glad I did. There's a long chapter that talks about, you know, the obsessive nature of crime solving in the internet age, you know, where people who don't know each other, people who have time and who have, you know, resources and have ingenuity, can collaborate together and sometimes debate with one another and build theories about the case. And it's a sloppy process, obviously. There are some people have telenal vision, other people wind up, you know, the debates turn in, you know, get a little rancorous and turn into fights. But I've been very impressed the part of Web Sleuths, those forums about the Long Island serial killer case have been very, very interesting, and a lot of very thoughtful people on them. And I only dip into the pool in the book to talk about it, and I interviewed in person one Web Sleuth, but I must say, now that I'm on the air here, I really liked it all.
Well, thank you, and I've got to say, I'm very proud of Web Sleuth, and I have to give credit where credit is due, and that is the incredible moderators that volunteer and work so hard to make sure that everybody stays in line, because like you said, it can get pretty rough out there, and people get very personal. I mean, there was a time when we had everybody accusing each other of being the Long Island serial killer and posting on Web Sleuth, and it was the moderators that brought sanity back. So I have to give total credit to those mods. They know the case, they work it well, and they care about it. They care about the victims, and they care about the posters. So hats off to them for doing such an amazing job. And it is the best on the internet. You go, and I'm not trying to brag. It's just true. You go anywhere else, and it's name calling and ugliness and just horrible. And Web Sleuth is none of that. So thank you for recognizing that and for acknowledging that in your book. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you're more than welcome. It is interesting how you wander around online, and often when people dip into subjects like this, it's not just pointing and name-calling, but it's accusing people of being not even who they say they are, accusing them of being sock puppets, assuming one person of taking on 10 identities in order to gang up on someone else. And then sooner or later, the conversation moves off the initial subject entirely and becomes just about, you know, what they're going to do to each other if they ever run into each other in a dark alley. So it gets wild. But at the same time, the value that has been added to the case, there's a lot of research in this book that initially appeared on Web Sleuth, you know, legal documents that have been tracked down by Web Sleuth people before I saw it. And I need to give credit where credit is due.
I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's absolutely it is fascinating to me, because I'm like, I have no clue how you go about it. And it just seems so easy. It just comes so easy to them. What's so fun about it too is, Bob, we don't know these people. We don't know each other. They've just all come together for one purpose, and that is to solve the case, to help someone they don't even know. And that, again, is another great thing about the internet. But then, as oftentimes we see with great things, there is also a very, very dark side. And in your book about the victims of the Long Island serial killer, you talk about how the internet made it possible for these women. They're not – well, one of them was a streetwalker, but the others weren't, if I'm not mistaken. I want you to give us a little bit of background about them and how the internet played such a huge part in their life and in their murder as well.
Sure. And I'll start by saying that what I really one of the things that motivated me the most to do a book about this, despite the fact that the killer was still at large, was that I thought that the women's lives told us something new, not just about prostitution, but about a part of America that doesn't get discussed much. Different parts of, you know, small towns and small enclaves within urban areas where options have been narrowing for years, where the best jobs don't offer health benefits and aren't even full time. A lot of these women, they're, you know, one woman's mother works at Walmart, another one prepares meals at an assisted living facility. They live in places where there were good union jobs a generation or two ago, and now they live in places where prostitution may still be frowned upon, but it's nevertheless becoming a very tempting option for someone in a particular situation. It's really, in that way, I wanted the book to be about suburban desperation and something that we really don't talk about much. And in the media, we kind of focus on other things. But I'll get into them one by one. And they all got into this for slightly different reasons. And, you know, a lot of the stereotypes that we talk about when we talk about this profession, they do pop up, but they are not universal. I mean, there is some neglect, there is some substance abuse, there is some sexual abuse in the past with some of these women. But there are also women who do very, very well in school, who get A's. One of them graduated a year early from high school. Another one, despite all the odds, went back and got great grades and graduated from high school. So that wasn't universal. But the big universal thing to me was the money. They all knew they could make more money in one night than their friends could make in 2 weeks working at other jobs. I'll start with Maureen. Maureen Brainerd Barnes grew up in Groton, Connecticut. Groton, Connecticut is a Navy town in the sort of northeastern corner of the state, right before you get to Rhode Island on Route 95 if you're driving north. Mm-hmm. And she was a child of a single mother, and the mother worked constantly. And she and her younger brother and her younger sister sort of took care of one another growing up in public housing there. She did great in school until she dropped out when she was 16 because she and her boyfriend were expecting a baby. They married. They lived away from.
How old was she?
16. She was 16.
God. Okay.
She and her boyfriend got married. They were in love. They moved out of town for a while and then moved back again. They drifted apart as a couple, but had an amicable separation. Didn't actually divorce for a couple of years later, and had an amicable sharing of custody of their daughter. And the daughter mostly lived with the father because he was in Mystic, which is a better school district, Mystic, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. But Maureen saw her all the time. So she then had to build a life on her own, and she, you know, no job stuck for long. She tried to work at the local casinos. She worked at the local gas station. She tried it all, and nothing really stuck. And she was staying with her sister for a very long time, and staying with boyfriends for a very long time, and here was a case where she eventually happened upon escort work, first locally and then in New York, as a way to make enough money to support herself and her daughter and to be independent and to really be able to live on her own. To, you know, at a certain point, you're not 18 anymore. You're 23, you're 24. Yeah. And you wonder what you're going to do next. And so she chose this. She would take trips into New York for a couple of days at a time and then come back. She would call them modeling trips. Half of her friends knew about it, but a lot of her friends did not. And knew what they really were, I mean, what these trips were.
Yeah, right.
And she, you know, she felt like this could perhaps be the stepping stone to something else, to, you know, a way to sort of enlarge her life a little bit. And there's a way to rationalize this, you know, while it's happening. I mean, you certainly don't think you're going to be murdered when you get into this line of work.
And you're just doing it just for a short time until you can get everything else together in your life. And it's just, it's not permanent. It's not, you're going to do this all, not all the time, you know?
Exactly. So when she disappeared, she was at near Penn Station. She was down there for this trip because she needed to make enough money to avoid eviction court. She was she had a court date a few days later, and she was trying to make enough money to pay her back rent in order to not have to go to housing court.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed a little longer than her friends who were down there, and she broke one of her own little rules she normally had, which is to never be unaccompanied on a trip to New York. And sure enough, she disappeared, and it isn't clear what happened. You know, one thought is that perhaps somebody picked her up at Penn Station and convinced her to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it isn't clear exactly what happened. And she never told her loved ones that she ever went out to Long Island. And yet that's where her body was found 3 years later. It's very mysterious. And perhaps the most tragic part about her disappearance is the way that the police treated her family, who, you know, basically had to run down and do their own investigation, you know, riding down to New York and to talk to the people who worked at the hotel, to walk around and see whatever they could find. And of course, nobody knew anything about what had happened to her, and that was especially frustrating. And
when
to get
you,
the police to
say,
pay attention was.
Wait, so the police, what you're saying basically is they just said, "Oh, we don't care. You know, she's just a hooker."
Yeah.
Basically, is what they were saying.
They said, you know, she's over 21. She doesn't have any past mental illness or any other things that might, you know, make her seem especially vulnerable. Maybe she's just on a long vacation. Maybe she found some friends or a way to make money. They didn't take it as seriously as they might otherwise do. Mm-hmm. I'm a great admirer of Maureen's sister, Melissa Cann, and I interview her a lot in the book. And Melissa has since done a lot of digging and talked to a state investigator's office, you know, some sort of ombudsman's office in Connecticut, to go and open her sister's case file to find out exactly what they were doing and what they weren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that at some point the NYPD took over the case, and then they started getting a little bit more traction and hearing from a nice detective who was able to let them know that they were looking into past Johns of Maureen's, but again, not finding out anything. What they learned was, the one thing they learned was that her cell phone had pinged off of a cell tower off in Long Island, not far from where her body was eventually found. And that, at the time, was extremely mystifying to Maureen's sister. But
mm-hmm.
then when the TV reports came on that the bodies of four escorts were found on Long Island, she immediately knew that one of them had to be her sister.
And you may have said this, and I apologize if you did, Bob, but did her family have any idea that she was involved in this at all?
They had a small inkling, but didn't know every detail. And this is where it gets, I think, gets very, you know, the book hopefully sheds a little bit of light on what it must be like to be a family member of somebody who's made this decision. I mean, you love this person. It's not like it is in the movies where somebody says, "Get out of this house, and I never want to see you again," and the women are lost or gone long before they actually ever run into trouble. Maureen was not an outcast. She maintained very close ties to her family. What happens is it's just awkward. You know, as a sister or a brother or a mother, you don't want to bring it up. You don't want to take them to task for it. You don't want to be too aggressive about it because you're afraid you might alienate them even further and push them away even further. And
okay.
So you're afraid for them. You're worried about them. You may not approve of them, but also she's not 16. She's 24.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's very little you can't really have as deep a conversation with as you might otherwise be able to do.
Exactly. We're talking with Robert Kolker. We call him Bob. He's the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery about the Long Island serial case victims. He goes into in-depth background into the victims as well as the case itself. And we just heard about Maureen Barnes. Was that our first victim?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so next is Melissa Bartholomew, right?
That's right, Melissa Bartholomew. She grew up in Buffalo, New York. Her mother also was a single mother, but she was raised by her grandparents and her mother, and had an aunt who was very close to her too. So it's hard to imagine that she brought herself up or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The family was very affectionate with one another. She was a high-spirited young girl who was, very lovable. Everyone I talked to up in Buffalo had very fond memories of her. She was, very strong-willed and had, at a certain point went to live with her father, who at this point had lived in Texas, and things didn't work out there, and she came home again, and then she ended up finishing high school, which nobody had expected her to do because they thought that she was so eager to go off and live her life. She told her mother that she, this is the girl whose mother, by the way, works in an assisted living facility. She told her mother that she really, that she really wanted to be able to support herself, she didn't want to end up having a career like her mother's. She wanted something bigger for herself. She had dreams and ambitions. And eventually, she went and got a certificate at a cosmetology school in Buffalo and was very disappointed to find that the best she could do was get some shifts at Supercuts, at a couple of locations at Supercuts in Buffalo. And that was a bit of a letdown for her. She stuck around for a year, maybe more, but then a boyfriend offered to take her to New York to cut hair there, and she saw a chance to maybe make enough money to come back and open a salon. So she went to New York, and she lived there for several years, I believe 2 or 3 years. She would go back to Buffalo. At first she said things were going well, and then she said, well, not so well. She said that the hair salon didn't work out. She said that she was dancing at a club. She assured them that she was taking care of herself and that she was always safe. In reality, she was walking the street and was working for a pimp who she was in a relationship with, a guy named John Terry, who goes by the name Blaze. He will tell you that he was her boyfriend and not her pimp, but the police call him a pimp. I need to note the difference of opinion there.
Yes,
to be fair.
Major difference. Major difference there.
Exactly.
Bob, can we interrupt? We do have a question, and I want to get this in while we can.
Of course.
Actually, it is Michael from Minnesota. He's my co-host. He's jumped on here. I guess he's feeling a little better. How's your headache, Michael?
It's okay. It's there, but I'm functional.
Oh, that's
I'm
good.
Glad
that's
to hear
good.
It.
We like it when you're functional. Do you have a question for Bob Colker, author of the book about the Long Island serial killer victims?
I do. In this day and age, Bob, with all of the internet technical savvy that the police department and different law enforcement agencies have, why were they not able to trace any IP addresses of these girls and their Craigslist solicitors?
The police have not offered a complete explanation of this. There are some things we know. The first is that when a John goes on Craigslist or Backpage and sees an ad from a particular escort, he is not clicking on that ad or going to that person's web page. And so there is no direct ISP traceable in those situations. Instead, they just see the ad on a page, with the heading of adult entertainment or massage or whatever it is, and the ads keep bumping up and refreshing automatically. So let's say they see one that a woman they want to call. There's a cell phone number, and they dial that cell phone number, and the woman picks up, and they arrange to meet. So it wouldn't be an ISP that one would trace. It would be the phone that you would trace. But if you are someone who doesn't want to be detected, you could buy a burner. And you could buy it under a false name. You could list it to Mickey Mouse, which is what one burner in the book is listed to.
Oh,
and you could do it with a fly-by-night company, and so the ability to trace might not be easy. And you could call from a major metropolitan area like New York City, where it's not really easy to say exactly where you're calling from. And then look at it from the other side, the women they're sharing phones. They may have 4 or 5 different phones. They all are contract phones. They all are burners. And so I don't know if that makes it easier or harder for the police to trace their phone contact. I do know, based on reports, that police did look up old Johns of these women. So there had to be at least some phone activity that they were able to tap into. But it seems pretty clear that they didn't find that magic, you know, John who had talked to all four women. If they had, that would have slipped out at some point. As it stands, they are begging the public for more information.
We're talking with Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery about the victims of the Long Island serial killer case. Michael in Minnesota, my darling official unofficial co-host, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does very clearly. Thank you so much.
Okay, Michael. I'm glad you're feeling better.
I'll put you back on hold so you can listen. If you have another one, just let me know, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Okay, so Bob, we're going through the victims now, and we're on Melissa Bartholomew, and we have found out that her pimp is saying that he wasn't her pimp, he was her boyfriend, and the police are saying, no, he was a pimp, and she was a girl that had a loving family, and she got her cosmetology license, couldn't get a job, and kind of fell into this, and that's where we left off.
Yes, and so, you know, in Lost Girls, I talk with a close friend of Melissa's, and I learn all about her life in New York, and you can learn what it's like, even in this day and age, in the new cleaned-up New York City, to, you know, what life is like for women who walk the street, and it was quite eye-opening for me. Melissa disappeared on July 12, 2009. She was last seen outside of the place that she was renting in the Bronx. She took a lot of money out of the bank. Or no, she deposited a big check into the bank for like cash. Sorry, she deposited $1,000 cash in the bank and then took about $100 out. And that was the last anyone heard of her. She had talked on the phone, setting up an appointment in Long Island. It's possible that the police know where that appointment was, but for some reason, again, the lead went nowhere. What's most notable about Melissa's disappearance is that the police were notified a day or two after she dropped out of sight, and they didn't care. They told the family's lawyer that she was a hooker and that they weren't going to assign a detective to something like this.
Oh,
they
dear.
Only started a missing persons investigation 10 days later. And the reason why they did that was because Melissa's younger sister, Amanda, started getting anonymous phone calls from someone menacing, saying that he knew Melissa and what had happened to her.
Do you
think
that was
true? Believe that this is the only contact that the killers had with anyone on the phone.
Do you think that it really was the killer then that called in? That
yes,
called her?
And the police do too. It's a little strange because it's a little out of character. You don't hear about it in any of the other cases, but he basically tormented her, and the police weren't able to successfully, you know, trace it to a specific phone. They did not tape any of the calls either, which would have been good for voice analysis.
Sure.
But he said things like, you know, are you going to be a whore like your sister? And I'm watching her body rot, you know, things like that.
So he knew he got her sister's phone number somehow, obviously from maybe her cell phone or for an
address. Yeah, he was calling from Melissa's phone. He was calling from Melissa's phone.
Okay, so he had the phone. Okay. Oh, that's just awful. Yeah. So, what? And when was the last time she received a phone call from this freak?
Well, Melissa disappeared in July, and the last call was sometime in August. I think there were 8 or 9 calls in all.
Oh, that poor woman. My God.
And that made the news at the time in Buffalo. That was in the local news. And so.
Well, that's big. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so once her body was found a year and a half later. Hers was the first to be found, by the way, by the cadaver dog. Then suddenly those phone calls made national news. Everyone wanted to know more about those phone calls.
Right. I'm wondering why he stopped. Maybe he was afraid that he was going to get caught because I'm assuming he was just loving the torment. And, you can really just come up with a psychological profile of this freak. And who knows if it's right or wrong, but, boy, he is one very vicious, messed up dude. And so now we have Megan Waterman is our next victim, correct?
That's right. Megan, the next to disappear is Shannon Gilbert.
Oh, Shannon
actually,
Gilbert. Okay, that's right.
That's the interesting thing. She disappears in the middle of the timeline. And we know all about her disappearance the way I've explained it. And about her life, she She had a very complicated childhood. She was extraordinarily bright. She's the one who graduated high school early, but she had a difficult relationship with her family. She lived in foster care in several foster homes for most of her childhood, but it was more or less in the same town as the rest of her family, as her mother and her three sisters. So she would go to the same school as her sisters, have a lot of the same friends as her sisters, but would not go home at night to be with her family. And that was became something that really informed her childhood greatly. She felt like the black sheep. And in a way, one reason why she wanted to, why the money appealed to her from this career was that it would give her power in this situation. It's a struggling working class family. And here she suddenly was able to come home and buy presents for everyone. It would sort of, in her mind, win her back into her family.
Oh, my gosh, that's just tragic.
All according to her, sister and her friends all talking about this.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's remind everybody that Shannon Gilbert was the first person the police were looking for when they came upon the other bodies, and she was the third body to be found.
She was the third to disappear, but they spent a long time looking for her body. They didn't find her body for a year and a half. It was a full year after the first four were found.
The first four. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused here. So we're talking about five victims basically that we know of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
remains found along the beach, I should mention.
We haven't been able to identify who those belong to because they weren't full sets. Is that correct?
Yes, there's one body that they identified. They had found other parts of her remains elsewhere a few years earlier. She mm-hmm. also was an escort. So you see a relationship there. She, her story is even... is very sad. She had just come up from Washington, D.C. You imagine, the killer using the Internet to go shopping for just the right victim.
And he certainly has been. We're talking with Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, about the Long Island serial killer victims, as well as the case itself. And we have talked about Maureen Barnes, Melissa Bartholomew, also Shannon Gilbert, and now I believe it's Megan Waterman is next
up.
Yes,
we're back to the girls in burlap now with Megan Waterman.
Okay. And all of these girls were found in burlap, is that correct, or most of them?
Well, the four, Maureen and Melissa and Megan and Amber, were all found in burlap.
That's
the other sets
bizarre.
Of remains are slightly different, and there are competing theories about whether they're the same killer or whether, and the killer simply refined his technique over time, or whether this happens to be a convenient dumping ground for bodies. And
that's
an open question.
So we're on to Megan Waterman.
Megan grew up outside of, in Portland, Maine, and then just outside of Portland, Maine. And she was in love with her boyfriend, who was also her pimp. His name is Akeem Cruz, and he's currently incarcerated. Police have gotten him on the Mann Act. And he did, technically transport her over state lines. There's some debate in the book as to whether he coerced her or not. Most of her friends believe she wasn't technically coerced or trafficked in the traditional sense. And yet these Romeo pimp situations are always very complicated. And it's very possible that he had some sort of power over her.
Sure.
She was a free-spirited young woman who was really sort of the center of her family. Everyone, she was a volatile personality, but also very lovable. She had a daughter, a young girl who she wanted to support.
Oh.
And then this boyfriend who, was a drug dealer and part of a crew of guys who had moved up to Portland for the time being from New York. And, mm-hmm. She wanted to marry him and have a family with him and have another child with him. And they were close. But only as close as these things go. I mean, it's an old story now, the Romeo pimp situation, where he winds up actually basically being her manager more than anything
mm-hmm.
else. And they would
and
go down to
money.
Long Island to the hotel, the Holiday Inn Express down in Long Island, and she would work for a few nights and make money, and then they'd come back together. But this time she disappeared.
Oh dear. And so what does he say about all of this? I'm sure he was interviewed. What's his story?
Her friends who talked to him right immediately after that said that he was in a panic. They said that he was not with her that night, and that is one of the more damning things that you could say about him, that he's brought this woman down to work and make money for both of them, and he doesn't even stick around to work security. Like he
goes
sure off
she's okay.
somewhere else. Yeah.
Sure.
So he comes back in the morning and she's gone, and he doesn't know where she's been. He last saw her a couple hours before she disappeared. There's a security camera at the hotel that sees her leaving the hotel sometime after midnight, and that's the last people here, you know, have ever had seen her alive. He didn't want to talk to the police because there was an outstanding warrant for his arrest. He had had a weapons charge back in Brooklyn, and so he got on the phone with detectives and told them about, you know, what jewelry she was wearing and, you know, his description and whatnot, but he never talked to them in person and would never say where he was. And eventually, of course, he went back to Portland and police picked him up immediately. And he, you know, they kept finding different reasons to keep him in jail until finally they found he got federal charges on the man.
Yeah, they got the goods on him. They got the goods on him.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you know, this is just beyond tragic. And how many more Megan Watermans are there out there? I'm sure there's hundreds of thousands, and it's just sad. So then we have Amber Lynn Castillo. Is it Costello or Castillo?
Costello. She's a Southern girl from Wilmington, North Carolina. She was sexually abused at a young age. She was, but ironically, her family might have been the closest family in the book. The parents stayed together. She was very close to her older sister, but her older sister got involved with an escort service in Wilmington, and Amber followed in her sister's footsteps, and the two of them eventually freelanced together. They moved to Florida at the same time. Amber was a tormented person who gave up escort work for many years and married and had a religious life and then relapsed. And moved up to Long Island again to be with her sister who had moved up there, and relapsed again and went working on Craigslist again. And this is when she finally disappeared. This might be the saddest story in the book, and yet it's extremely compelling because you see just what the career was doing for her, how it was sustaining her. She really needed a family, and she needed people to be close to, and doing this kept her sister in her life, and it's very sad to see.
Yeah. Bob, you said that Amber was sexually abused, but her parents did stay together. Was it family abuse or was it friend? Did they know who abused her?
It was a neighbor, and she was six, and they moved out of town where they had been living immediately, and you know the family kind of fell to pieces for a while and lived apart for a while. One sister lived with one parent, one with another, but eventually it. You know, a few months later, they all rejoined one another and set up a new life together in Wilmington, and had a stable time in Wilmington in a very bad part of town. But they were together,
and that's what she wanted. She just wanted to be with her family. This is so heartbreaking, and it doesn't end with Amber, unfortunately. We're talking with Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. You can get this book on Amazon. You can get the Kindle version, hardback, paperback. It's all there for you, and it's all about the victims in the Long Island serial killer case, the victims that we know of anyway. And Bob has done some intense investigative research, and we're going to talk about that now because Shannon Gilbert was found in the middle of all of this, and yet she was kind of in my mind she's kind of the first one, because she was the first one that if I remember correctly they were really out actively searching for, because she ran away screaming or ran away terrified, and yet they didn't find her. They found these other bodies first and then they found her later. But the bizarre thing, Shannon Gilbert drowned, or so say the law enforcement agencies. They say, according to the autopsy, Shannon Gilbert was not murdered, but she drowned. And I think, Bob, you have a different feeling about what happened to Shannon, correct?
That's right. This is where things get contentious in the book, because at a certain point, the police commissioner at the time in this investigation stands up and says, we think everybody in this case is connected except for Shannon. We think one killer killed all the people whose remains are along the highway. But we think the woman whose case started it all, the woman whose disappearance led to the discovery of the other bodies, was actually an accidental death. And his argument, this is Commissioner Richard Dormer of the Suffolk County Police, his reasons for this are interesting, and they are, to the extent possible, they're compelling, because he says that if you look at Shannon, she doesn't exactly fit the same MO as the other women. What he points to is that she had company, that she had a driver who was working security for her, coming all the way out with her to Long Island for that call. And he said the killer took such great pains to make sure that these other victims were alone so that he could control the situation. It seems unlikely that that Shannon would have fit into that. He also argues that the John who brought her out there has been cleared. Now, the John, again, his name is Joe Brewer. He's all, from the very start, said that he never intended to hurt her, that he even says that they never had sex, which is slightly hard to believe. And yet, yeah, in the middle of the date, she's screaming, they're trying to kill me, into the phone. She's scared enough to call 911, which an escort almost never does. Because of the consequences.
It's like, okay, I can see them calling if their life was on the line, because otherwise they could probably end up arrested. So
exactly.
I just don't understand. Why did they think she was in some sort of drug-induced paranoia episode happening? How do they get over that?
Yeah, the commissioner essentially believes that she was in a panic and in a drug-induced psychosis, and that she knocked on a bunch of doors and then at one point ran into the marsh, misjudging how far, you know, she thought maybe that she could just cut right through and get to the highway on the other side. And that actually it was a full quarter mile to a half mile to get to the highway, and that eventually she died in the marsh, or maybe she bumped her head, or she drowned. The autopsy was inconclusive there. But the inconsistencies there are just remarkable. I mean, first of all, she called 911. She stayed on the phone with 911 for 23 minutes. She said, they're trying to kill me. She avoided not only the John and not only all the neighbors who were trying to help her, but the man who supposedly was her security for that evening, her driver, a fellow named Michael Pack. She was running from him as well. The only one who could have gotten her home that night. I mean, she didn't know where she was. She'd never been to Oak Beach before. And yet she's running from the one person who could take her home. And then, you know, there are physical evidence that's just astonishing. Her body is found not far from the side of the highway, more than a quarter of a mile away from where they say she entered the marsh. And yet her belongings, her purse, her lipstick, her phone, her jeans, her clothes, are all found close by to where they say she entered the marsh, a full quarter of a mile away from her body. No, so the police are essentially saying that she went into the marsh disrobed and then went a full quarter mile before dying, which seems like a very, very unlikely scenario given how thick and how tangly and how tall this marsh was and how deep the water was in this marsh, which is essentially a big bathtub filled with rainwater and seawater.
And I don't see how...
What time of year was this?
Oh, go ahead. This is Michael in Minnesota. What time of year was this?
It was the early morning of May 1st. So it was a bit cool.
Yeah, cool.
Well, I have another question. Oh, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, yeah,
go ahead.
No, I didn't say anything. Honey.
Okay. I'll take it from here then. Thanks, Michael. Bob, what I don't get is how they can. Okay, first of all, let me back all the way up. What drugs did they find in her system? Do we know that?
Yeah, that's yet another thing. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, the assumption or the implication the police are making is that she was not of sound mind. But they didn't find any evidence of any drugs in her system in the autopsy, and it's not clear exactly how hard they search for drugs. Again, alcohol is hard to search for in an autopsy because that burns off, but you can certainly find evidence of anything from pot to hallucinogens to mood-altering drugs or antidepressants. You can find all sorts of things. And they didn't find any of it. And it doesn't, again, they didn't necessarily look that hard, which is very, very strange.
You would think that would be their main thing that they would look for, because they're saying, okay, yeah, she called the police and said that they're killing me. You would think that would be the one thing they would look for to back up their story. Can she be exhumed, or has she been cremated? What's the scoop?
Her remains, last time I checked, are still in the custody of the Suffolk County Police. Shannon's family, her mother Mary and her sister Cherie and their attorney John Ray, would like to have an independent examination of her remains, but that costs money, and so they're sort of in a holding pattern. So I have a little more detail on the autopsy, on the medical remains.
Let's hear that, please, if you can.
Yeah, they had some challenges, according to the reporting I did in the book. They needed bone marrow to really search for the real evidence of that she might have been on substances at some point, but they couldn't find any in a femur bone that they had. And for reasons that were never explained to Shannon's family, they didn't crack open any of the other bones in her remains. Instead, they used a little bit of tissue from her brain and a small clump of hair, which they tested for cocaine, and the tests were negative. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't eliminate the possibility that Shannon had done coke that night, because especially since the hair had spent a year and a half, in a marsh deteriorating in salt water. But it did make it less likely that she had. And even if nothing she had taken that night had seeped into her bones, the theory that she was high that night is suddenly less plausible if she didn't have any traces of some cocaine in her system. So what the police found in the autopsy did not help their case.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't test for any other drug, not even pot, not even psychotropics, not even for meth. They didn't test for anything else.
I don't understand
The best explanation is that they were convinced, based on the other evidence, that this was an accidental death, and so they didn't want to go looking too hard for anything that might disprove that, any signs of trauma or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I should mention that the Shannon's skeleton was basically intact, just like the others, with the exception of her little hyoid bones up in the neck were missing. Now, the hyoid bones are, for anyone who's on web sleuths regularly, you probably know exactly what they are. They're
do.
The tiny little
but,
bones.
But enlighten us, but we do. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, they're the first things to crack if somebody's being strangled. And the reports about the other Gilgo Beach victims is that they all were strangled. And if you can't find those bones when you have basically every other bone in Shannon's body recovered from the scene, one could assume that perhaps she'd been strangled too. But they didn't find those bones, and the police have an explanation for that too. They say that they're so tiny, those bones, that they could be taken away by animals. They could have just not been able to be recovered.
But why
You're
those
sitting there in a marsh for 18 months.
But just why those? I mean, out of all the bones in the body, it just seems very odd that the ones connected with being strangled are the ones that are missing. Come on.
Exactly.
I can't believe
and
the
so
cops are doing this.
Yeah, and this is why Shannon's mother, Mary Gilbert, said she felt betrayed by their actions. And this is why Shannon's family has filed a lawsuit to try and get more information about what was going on here.
Tell us about that lawsuit. How can they do that ongoing investigation?
Yeah, here we get into the deep, deep web sleuth-related stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Gilbert family's lawsuit is not against the police. It's against Dr. Charles Peter Hackett. Dr. Hackett is a local doctor in Oak Beach who, for many years, was a prominent member of the community, well-known as a physician who could went out of his way to be helpful to many neighbors, even offered medical treatment. For a long time, he had been a figure of interest to reporters reporting on this case because Mary had said that he had actually contacted her after Shannon's disappearance, saying that he had seen her and tried to help her. Now, Dr. Hackett has always denied saying that to Mary, and for a time he even denied making the phone calls to Mary and having those conversations at all. What makes this a very mysterious thing is that he did, in fact, make phone calls to Mary. And so the question is why he would say he didn't when, in fact, he did.
And especially since it would be so easy to find out if he was lying. That just makes me think that he's just a little bit off kilter, perhaps. That's how bizarre. What in the
right,
world
so
was
you,
he thinking?
Well, you know, weirdly, I had it in mind to ask you what he might be thinking because you, as an organizer of such an amazing web forum, might see this phenomenon in other cases. Perhaps there's someone who, at some point, is eager to insert themselves into the investigation.
Oh, absolutely.
But then, then suddenly everybody turns at them and says, "Hey, maybe you did it, pal." And then things get very, very complicated.
Does
that happen a lot?
Well, that does happen. And there are times when it hasn't happened a lot, but there's been former members of Web Sleuths who haven't actually inserted themselves into a case. And that gets very sticky and very difficult. But about this particular doctor calling her, you brought up something which I think could be it. He just wanted to be involved, really involved, and then probably, my guess would be, had second thoughts after he made that phone call. And went, "I shouldn't have done that."
Yeah, and probably wished he hadn't.
Right.
There are conspiracy theorists out there who think that he is not saying everything about what happened that morning with Shannon, that he was, you know, there are secondhand reports that all the neighbors were calling him that morning when she was going around banging on doors and that he must have known something about it at the time. There are, again, like secondary reports, not first-hand reports, that he was telling other people that he saw her. He's denied all of this roundly. I need to be especially fair to him. I don't want to say in this forum or anywhere that I, you know, suspect him of any foul play. But I can say that a lot of Lost Girls, a large section of the book, talks about the conspiracy theories surrounding him and other people in the neighborhood. It gets into some of the feuds and some of the history of Oak Beach, Long Island, and why this might have been the absolute worst place for someone like Shannon to disappear.
Right. And we do have there are people on the forum that believe the doctor had something to do with it. But like you said, there is nothing to indicate that at all. And it was just an odd thing. It was just odd for him to do, and therefore it made him look suspicious. When you do something strange like that, and you're right smack dab in the middle of a serial killer case, it's going to turn the spotlight on you. And I think he did it, and then just, like I said, went, "Oh, dear God, what did I do?" And tried to backtrack.
Trish, I have a question.
Michael in Minnesota, go ahead.
Yes. Was the driver ever able to say which house he dropped Shannon off, or Sharon with the Shannon off at?
Yes, it was at Joe Brewer's house. The John Joe Brewer was interviewed by police, and the commissioner has said over and over that he's cleared and yet what we don't know is what happened in that house that made Shannon so angry, so upset, so frightened for her life. To the point where she would call 911 and say, "They're trying to kill me." And he hasn't explained that either. I have a long interview with him in Lost Girls, and he basically is by equal turns defiant and self-centered and self-obsessed. He starts to point fingers at other people. It's kind of a fascinating look at a very strange individual.
Now, is this a wealthy enclave of Long Island?
That's something that I tried to clear up, too, in the book. I mean, the press coverage talked about it as a millionaire's row. And I guess technically you could say that because of the run-up in property values over the decades. I mean, if you have oceanfront property in the New York area, you might be a millionaire on paper. But the place doesn't look like the Hamptons or like Malibu or anything like that, or like South Beach. It's kind of suburban. It's these small little bungalows, some of which have been torn down and turned into little McMansions. And it's kind of a bare bones existence where the phones go out often, and the services from town, like things like garbage collection, all are kind of spotty. And the most important thing about Oak Beach in terms of it being a millionaire's row or not is that they don't own the land that the houses are on. It's on state property. And so they pay money for the village gets together and pays money on for a lease from the state. That means that if you're, you know, Bill Gates, you would never buy there because who knows, you know, 30 years from now, the state might decide to invalidate your lease and take over the beach. So no real powerful millionaire would really live in a place like that because who knows, they could lose the house one day. So they're working class people who have had the good fortune to have this, you know, great location, and but really it might be all they have.
And Bob, I want to ask you a question about Shannon Gilbert's John. What was his name? Joe
Brewer.
Joe Brewer. Mm-hmm. When you said, what happened? Why did she call 911? What did he say?
He said, well, that's the question, isn't it? And, you know, I think I have an answer to that, and maybe I'll tell it to you one day. And then he started chuckling.
Oh, my God.
You know, I've talked to other reporters who have spoken to him, and they said, oh, my God, were you taping the phone call that I had with him? Because he basically did the same thing with them, too.
Oh,
wow.
Geez.
I think she stumbled on that murderer. Maybe it was Joe, and maybe there's more than one murderer, and they were there to take her. And when they realized she snuck out and...
You have hit.
You
have hit the nail on the head, because there are a lot of people that believe that, Michael. That's interesting that you picked up on that. Isn't that right, Bob? There's a lot of people
right.
that think there's two people working together here.
Right, and then the biggest theories, the theories that really dig into Dr. Hackett, for instance, I don't want to say I believe this because I don't necessarily do it all. But they say that you take someone who's living in this community who's abducting women, and then one day, lo and behold, a potential victim is basically delivered to his front door because of his wacky neighbor. So he does that, victimizes her as well. That's sort of the theory that's been bouncing around on Web Sleuths and other places, that he just sort of lucked into another victim.
Yeah, it was just it was a lucky drop off, if you will. But again, we're certainly not saying that the doctor is responsible. It's unfortunately his name is out there, and he is now basically a public person. But we're not. I want to tell everybody, you can't go on Web Sleuths and start talking about it and breaking the rules just because we're talking about it here. Okay, we have rules. We don't name innocent people. As saying that they're serial killers, it's just against our rules. Call us crazy, if you will. Let me gather my thoughts.
Oh, and
he
also denies all the allegations. He's responded to that lawsuit from Shannon's family too, and he's contesting it. He wants it thrown out. It's slogging its way through court. It's very possible that the lawsuit will be stopped in its tracks. What the lawsuit reminds me of is, it's sort of a smaller version of the civil litigation that Ron Goldman's family brought against O.J. Simpson. It's sort of a wedge meant to try to get people to be deposed and to testify who might offer more information about this case.
Understood. We're talking with Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an unsolved American mystery about the victims of the Long Island serial killer. And Bob also has a lot of information about the case directly itself. Also joining us from Minnesota is my official unofficial co-host, Michael. And we are taking questions. You can go to the chat room or feel free to call in. We would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 760-825-0933. And, Bob, I have a lot of questions. Is there anything else that you want to wrap up first before I get into some of our questions?
I wanted to thank the folks on Web Sleuths again. The discussions they had and the research they did was interesting. And I wondered as I was working on the book, you know, people have done so much and dug up so much. What do I have to offer? And the answer I came upon was, aside from talking about the women's lives in the case and their families, I could do personal interviews with a lot of the people who had been discussed online for a really long time. So I spoke with Michael Pack at length, and I spoke with Joe Brewer at length, and I spoke to Dr. Hackett. at length, and with the neighbors at Oak Beach who have opinions about the case, and with Gus Coletti, one of the last people to see Shannon alive. And I sort of took the measure of all of them, and my conversations with them end up being a large part of the second half of the book. And so for those of your listeners who wonder what might be new to them in this book, that's my answer. The one-on-one interviews might be new to you.
And that is certainly a major contribution, believe me, because every one of us would like to sit down with those people and talk to them. But we have to leave it up to you who are there. You're there at the scene, and you can do it. We can't. So thank you for that. What do you say to the people who think that the Long Island serial killer is a cop? That's a big one out there now.
Those reports popped up when people were putting together the stories of a lot of the other victims once they were named, and they saw that the calls couldn't be traced, and that those anonymous calls to Melissa Bartholomew's younger sister Amanda were never figured out. And so the assumption started running around saying, well, maybe the killer is so smart and knows how to evade detection because he's a cop. But it's not something the police ever. Oh, there also was a little bit of discussion because they were interviewing a few former Johns of some of the women, one of whom was a retired police officer. And so there was probably a lot of hope and anticipation on the part of the reporters that, well, if they're interviewing a former cop, that maybe they're close to getting an arrest. But things didn't pan out that way. I mean, I think it could be anybody. I don't believe it could necessarily have to be a cop. I mean, if you watch two or three episodes of CSI or SVU or Criminal Minds, you know how to avoid that kind of detection.
Exactly.
Yeah,
we do have, a lot of questions here, and I'll try to get to all of them. Let's talk about the burlap. The burlap has been a big, huge piece of evidence, I believe. Is there any more information about the burlap that you have found out about? Anything at all?
It is interesting. Somebody said to me recently, there should be more based on a very, very close analysis of that burlap to try to see if it came from somewhere specific. There isn't any public information about that I know about, nothing I can offer. All I can tell you is that Long Island is lousy with burlap. I mean, you got clammers, you've got horse people, you've got all kinds of fishermen, you've got landscapers. Joel Rifkin, by the way, was a landscape gardener. It's just everywhere. So it's one of those things that feels special but might actually be more work a day. But I don't have any special knowledge about the burlap.
Now, are there any theories out there about the suicides involving businessmen on the East Coast being connected to this? I haven't heard about this. Have you?
Yeah, this was banging around the internet. There was a prominent merchant who died way out on the east end of Long Island, ran a landscaping business, and people watching the case, probably were imagining an amazing Hollywood ending to this story, mm-hmm. thinking, well, landscaping business, there's burlap. Maybe he knew the heat was on, and out of a guilty conscience, he killed himself. And there was, of course, tremendous pushback on the internet from people who knew of this guy, saying, what possible indication do you have of this? How could you be so cruel to his family? And that's
true.
The last I had heard of it. I don't think it ever went beyond that.
And let me follow up on that, if I may, Bob. We're talking with Bob Kolker, the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, about the victims in the Long Island serial killer case. And I want to bring that up, Bob, because you and I talked off the air about how powerful words are on the internet. And I really want to stress this to people on the forums, on any forum, that if you find an obituary of, a landscaper who killed himself, and happened to live close by where these bodies were found, that's a horrible thing to make a leap like that, and then to put it on the internet for the family to see. My God, they're already going through hell. So I just think it's very important that people, first of all, you're not using your real names when you post this, so I know it's much easier to post things like that when you're not saying who you are. But keep in mind that it is very harmful and very hurtful, and your words are very powerful. And a lot of innocent people, in a lot of cases, have been dragged through the mud for no reason. And that's one thing that I'm very proud to say, that Web Sleuths moderators and members try very, very hard to avoid at all costs. So,
I noticed a lot of self-policing
on the forum. Get on my soapbox for a moment. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I noticed a lot of good self-policing on Web Sleuths, and it's very admirable. I think maybe why some people are tempted to do that sort of thing is that it feels like deduction. You know, what if it was the butler? Let us assemble a list of facts that might help us prove that it was the butler. And so it feels like a useful exercise that way because, hey, you're on the Internet. Other people might be able to help out. Let's build a case in theory. But the problem is that being on the Internet is like publishing. It's like sitting in the town square and shouting out, hey, everybody, what if it was the butler? And so that's potentially actionable.
Yes, absolutely. So, okay, we're talking about the Long Island serial killer case, actually the victims of the case, with Bob Kolker, author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. We do have some questions from our audience, and let me get to some more of those. Have you ever thought about a possible connection between Long Island serial killer and the Atlantic City murders in 2006? They were murders of prostitutes, I believe.
Yeah, the folks on Web Sleuths have worked very hard on this. It's really been quite amazing to see. And it's very tempting to associate them because those Atlantic City murders took place in 2006, which is right before Maureen Brainerd Barnes disappeared. It's a seaside community on the East Coast, not so far away from Long Island. You can imagine a killer traveling around. The victims are escorts. And not only that, one of the victims, Kim Raffo, apparently spent some time with her boyfriend out in Long Island. And so you've got some really compelling associations there. And the one thing that makes it very different is that there's a lot of evidence that several of the Atlantic City victims knew one another well and even lived with each other for a while. And so you start to think, well, maybe the reasons for their murders are different from these other murders. The other thing I would say, just in the context of that, is that Atlantic City and Gilgo Beach, those killings don't exist in a vacuum. And there are multiple murders of prostitutes in Detroit recently. And there's the terrible killing of 30 or 40 missing prostitutes in Montreal. It's not uncommon for there to be, sadly, multiple murders of escorts in any part of the world. So the fact that these are close together makes it interesting, but perhaps it's a false connection given the larger context.
Exactly. Bob, we do have a question, and we're going to go to area code. Let me get you on the line here. And hold on, it's a popping up. There we go. Area code 206206. You're on the air live with Bob Kolker and yours truly, Tricia. What is your question, my dear?
Hi,
area
Bob.
Code 206.
Hello?
Hi, who's this? Hi, who's this?
Hi, Tricia. This is Jan. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Hi. Fascinating discussion regarding the Long Island killer.
Thank you.
And Tricia, you brought up the burlap. That was one of my questions, and I can see there that's pretty much a system overload. But the similarities you brought up about being able that the victims were in burlap. And they're primarily from an escort service. And I guess being able to pinpoint this individual's location, whether he really is a resident or he obviously knows something about Long Island. And it made me think about through Texas State University, there is a program that was developed.
Where'd you go?
Ooh, that was getting interesting.
I know it was. Are you there, Jan? Oh, my gosh. I don't know what happened. She just disappeared. It happens. It goes into the vortex. It's a Tricia's True Crime Radio vortex. You just get sucked in, and eventually gets bit back out. Hopefully, Jan will call back, because that did sound interesting.
If you're out there, I'm going to Texas State in a couple of weeks for something unrelated to that, so I'm dying to know what's going on there.
Oh, yeah.
What they're up to.
call back. Anyway, I want to ask you a question about the burlap, because to me that just seems like one of the biggest clues that we know of that ties them all together. What industries use burlap? We know landscaper wood. We know, potato farmer. Who else? A builder, maybe like a mason person might use burlap. What have you ever put a list together of where this burlap might come from?
To that, I'd add clam fishermen, perhaps other people on boats might use burlap. And then I would add, a lot of Long Island is horse country. So there'd be burlap, used for, taking care of horses.
Right, right. And I buy bird seed and it comes in burlap. Just so many different things. Oh, here's Jan. She's calling back again. Hold on one second. Jan, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I don't know what happened. Just lost
I don't
you.
Either. Well, okay,
hooray.
Keep going, because we're fascinated by what you were going to say, so go for it.
Yes, and I don't know which part you were able to hear, the last part I left off about the program that was developed by this officer.
Was the program. The program was developed at Texas State, I think, and then that was it.
Yeah, Texas State, and he had actually, worked on this program to determine, the human behavioral theories. And so it's a mapping of, the locations of the bodies and where the people lived, and it looked at all of those areas, and it essentially kind of identifies where this particular person may be coming from. They literally go out and scope that entire area and look at how this type of person would know this area, where to do this, the times of day and night. They look at both of those things. And it was on the, geospatial intelligence. And a lot of police agencies are using it now so that they can kind of track these type of behaviors and get a better pinpoint. This, on a theory they based using the White Castle murders. And pretty much what they developed was the idea that it appeared to be a sea merchant. When he would come into town, then he would commit these, heinous crimes in White Castle and then be gone. And that's why they couldn't locate him. But, specifically. So I wondered if maybe the police were even looking at something like that, where, like a profile of this killer, because he sounds pretty devious to me, to be able to make those false. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know the FBI consulted with the Suffolk County Police, but I don't know anything beyond that. I think it's certainly fascinating to think about, where these women came from, where they lived, where they worked, and the places they went to in their final days, their final movements, and to be able to geolocate all those and try and draw associations is a tantalizing idea. And I wonder if anyone's attempted it. I would love to learn more about that guy.
Absolutely, and I would think that would offer a lot. I mean, for all we know, it could be something as simple as, they went into the same fast food restaurant, and he was able to. I mean, who knows? Who knows how it's all connected? It could be anything, and that's what is so frustrating about this. But about the killer himself, and we do all agree that it's a man, and I don't know if there's one or two, but like you and I were talking off the air, Bob, obviously this guy has some major issues, and when he is caught, and I do believe he will be caught, I think we're going to be able to learn a lot from him and to make sure that we don't create any more of these monsters. That's what we need to learn from these serial killers. Now, I do have a few more questions. Bob, is there anything that you want to touch on before I continue?
No, I'd love to hear these questions.
Okay. Somebody wants to know, why wasn't Brewer or Pack or Hackett arrested? Now, we kind of went over that, but maybe you can just kind of put it in a Reader's Digest version here real quickly.
Well, when Shannon disappeared, it wasn't even thought of as a missing persons case, much less a murder case. And so the police might have talked to the John, let's say hypothetically that they talked to Brewer that very morning. And he said, I don't know, she was here. I swear to God, we didn't have sex. And she ran away because she was crazy. and that's all I know. And there's no, you know, there's no body, and there's no evidence of her being around. And so the police shrug and move on their way, and they don't take it terribly seriously because they think, well, her and her driver just went away. They probably we're going to write this off as an argument. Mm-hmm. And only months later does it get treated like a missing persons case, and only months after that is she presumed murdered. And now, of course, they don't think she was murdered. But there was a period where they thought maybe she'd be murdered, and that's when they start aggressively interviewing the driver and Brewer, and they even interviewed Dr. Hackett for a while. But this is mm-hmm. months later, so the opportunity for physical evidence is kind of long since passed. And they have said repeatedly that none of those three people are suspects. And so either they are keeping their cards close to their chest and aren't going to say that they deep down suspect somebody, or they really and truly believe that these guys had nothing to do with it.
Well, it seems like they had probable cause to go into the John's house and look for any kind of evidence.
Yes, and they did finally search his house thoroughly after those four bodies were found 7 months later.
Months
oh, yeah.
later, yeah.
Right.
Yep. And they seized his car, too. But no, they found, they apparently didn't find anything.
Ugh, that's so frustrating. Very frustrating. I do have some more questions here. Let's see. How about, has anything in your research led you to look into the Gilgo area besides the finding of the remains? Supposedly there are some shady parties going on there, there's more drugs, prostitution. Is there more of kind of an underground, I don't know, party atmosphere, if you will, in this area that we're talking about?
I didn't get the sense that Oak Beach had a hidden kind of eyes wide shut kind of thing going on there. Mm-hmm. However, Brewer and Shannon, in the middle of their date, did get in the car and go off and run an errand and come back. And while Brewer says he didn't take any drugs that night, the driver, Michael Pack, says that the only reason they would pop out for a short errand like that would be to get drugs for the date.
Yeah, it's a drug run.
And if they're only out for 15 minutes, that means they had to have bought the drugs locally and not gone across the bridge and into Greater Long Island to go get the drugs, which means that a neighbor of theirs sold them the drugs. So, you know, that, you know, depending on how you would define things, would be nefarious activity in the neighborhood. And that's something none of the neighbors are really talking about.
But, I mean, I think you can go to any neighborhood in America and not have to go too far to find drugs somehow, somewhere. Let's talk a little bit about the neighbors. They have not been very helpful, have they? They don't like this.
Yeah, I mean, they've been defensive, and many of them have not been terribly compassionate. They have resented all of the media coverage and become even more defensive once, you know, the doors got knocked on even more. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say they haven't been cooperative with police, but, you know, certainly the security video wasn't handed over the second after a woman went screaming through the neighborhood. And so that kind of makes you wonder why they would be so guarded as to not even do that. They waited for, they took no action. And then according to at least one person I spoke to, the police only even asked for the video once those other bodies were found and it looked like a foul play had, you know, taken place. And by then, the hard drive had long since been, you know, written over with more recent video.
Oh.
So, you know, you'd think if she were the daughter of a judge or of the daughter of a doctor, or if she had been a college student at, you know, the local university, they probably would have handed the hard drive over. But because she was an escort visiting, you know, a neighbor who they may not have liked very much, they didn't want to get involved. And that stigma, I think, is something I try to really dig into in Lost Girls. I'm hoping that if we write about these women as human beings, that suddenly, you know, perhaps more of us out there and more in the media and more in law enforcement will treat them like human beings.
Exactly.
Well,
and
they
I think
are.
One thing...
That's exactly what they are. That's just terrible.
And Michael, I know you'll agree with me on this. They all started out, nobody starts out and thinks, I'm going to be a hooker. I'm going to, you know, go get into drugs and be a hooker. It doesn't ever work that way. These people are our children, and we've got to look, like you said, we've got to look at them as such. They are important. They are loved by other people. And to dismiss a person because they are so down on their luck and doing horrible things, I think it's just cruel. I don't know where our compassion has gone. It just seems to be seeping out very quickly these days. I do have another question here. This comes from an email. And the person wanted to know if the bodies were gutted, specifically Megan Waterman.
The reports say the skeletons were intact. The implication of those reports is that they were stripped of most of the flesh. And it's not clear if that's something that the killer did or something that, you know, time and the sea air did. I wish I had more precise information about that. But the cause of death that keeps popping up in the families, you know, when they're recalling what the police said to them, is strangulation. So I don't know if that doesn't really qualify as gutted, I don't think.
Well, I think it'd be too hard to tell because all the
yeah.
flesh is gone basically, so it's really hard to tell. Do you think there are? I don't know how you would even answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think there's more bodies out there in that area? Do you think he's moved on? What do you think's happening?
Well, they find bodies from time to time in different parts of Long Island, but it's a huge area with millions of people, and they find bodies everywhere. So every time it comes up, a lot of people, including some folks on Web Sleuth, show a link saying, hey, you know, just the other day there was a woman found in Huntington who had a drug past, was not necessarily a prostitute, nobody knows for sure. And, you know, if people think, well, maybe it's the same killer. Maybe it is. It's hard to know. I personally believe that nobody kills four women and arranges them with such specificity and shrouds them with burlap in the same exact way if they didn't want to maintain some sort of relationship to the crime and keep thinking about it, keep reliving it. And I think that's the sort of person who would also call up the younger sister of the victim and want to maintain, you know, want to sort of keep the party going by tormenting the younger sister. And a person like that, I think, might also appreciate the fact that his work has made the news.
Yeah.
And might want to keep on going. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's still out there.
Impressive Beach, could I ask a question? I've been reported as a desolate area. Most beaches have quite a bit of interest in, you know, people that are beachgoers love all beaches. Is this an area where people do not necessarily go to spend the day at the beach?
It's a string of little barrier islands that have been filled in so there's a highway. And the Gilgo Beach is a destination for locals. You need a local beach sticker to go to it. Years ago, it was really popular as a surfing destination, and people still like surfing there. But it's overshadowed in popularity by Jones Beach to the west and by Fire Island off to the east and the Hamptons off to the east. And so the Gilgo Beach to most people is just the nowhere land in the middle on your way from Jones Beach to Fire Island. It's only the locals who really know about it as a place where you could spend the day and have a really good time at the beach. And at night, the highway is completely desolate. You can't really see a thing. And you really basically only see sand dunes and the occasional parking lot for a beach by day too. So it's a strange thing that in such a populated area where, you know, you'd think the seaside would be jammed with activity at every inch of it, this is really 15 miles of no man's land in between the popular places.
It's not a real sandy, pretty area, is it? I mean, I just can't imagine laying a towel out there and enjoying yourself. It looks kind of
well,
mucky.
You'd have to go off the highway to one of the little beaches like Gilgo or Cedar Beach or Oak Beach, and then you can head over to the beach, and it's very pretty. It's not as gloriously pretty as Jones Beach or Robert Moses State Park or any of those, but it's certainly very nice. But you don't see any of that from the highway. Again, the highway is just a straight shot of nothing. And these bodies were left basically on the side of the highway. In the papers, that comes off as Gilgo Beach, because it is. It is part of Gilgo Beach, but it's really the side of the highway is where they were left.
And the fact that they were measured almost exactly 10 meters apart, was that it?
No, they were like all more, you know, it wasn't to the foot, but it was essentially each one of them was more around a tenth of a mile away from each other. So you imagine a van or a truck, you know, driving down the highway in the middle of the night on a straight shot. So you can tell if somebody else is with you on the highway because you can see their headlights from miles away. So you can tell when you're alone. And so the driver of the truck pulls over, throws the body into the bramble on the side of the highway, gets in the car, drives a little bit, pulls over, drops off another one, and then three, and then four. That's my assumption, is that these bodies were all dropped at the same time.
Store
them somewhere for a while. But maybe I'm wrong. That's just, I haven't spoken with a police officer about that. It's possible that he kept going back and adding bodies once they were dead, but I'm of more of a mind that he had them stored somewhere else and then dumped them there.
And what do you think of the other bodies that were found wrapped in plastic? Do you think that this killer evolved, or?
Yeah, the other remains that were found are different. They aren't fully intact. There is no burlap. Sometimes some remains are found along Ocean Parkway and Gilgo Beach, and then other bits are found further out in Manorville or other places. And sometimes in one case it's a child, and in one case it's a man. The police theory at one point was that the child was the child of a prostitute who was taking her child on calls. That at the very low end is something that tragically does happen, and that they also argue that the man was probably a cross-dresser and probably also a prostitute. So the theory goes that you have a killer of escorts who in the beginning isn't quite as choosy about who he kills, and over time refines his technique and starts to use the internet to really shop for exactly the right victim. That's the theory.
Sounds like it's very, very, very possible. I just want to make sure that we have a good visual here of where these bodies were found. Was it incredibly remote where they were dumped off, or was it just a place that nobody really walked along? Now, you said, you know, from the highway during the day you couldn't see it, or at night you couldn't see it, but how far did he have to go in to dump the bodies? Did he have to carry them, or did he just throw them off to the side?
Well, the four in burlap weren't so far from the edge of the highway. They were just, I want to say, you know, a few yards into the bramble. So you can imagine him dragging them in and then running back into the truck, you know, only taking a few minutes with each one, particularly since these were small women, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
The other sets of remains were found deeper in and in different spots. There wasn't quite the same uniformity. So it's hard to know.
What's your theory?
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, there's always a chance that this is like the swamps of northern New Jersey or like parts of Staten Island, where they became sort of notable as places where people disposed of bodies. But in that case, those were organized crime related. And these people, if you think about it, like, who out there is someone you wouldn't be able to identify? I mean, they haven't been able to identify a lot of these remains, these other five or six remains. And even a child, I mean, good Lord, you would know if a child is missing. A child has a birth certificate. And, you know, the departments of health keep track of children. So how is it that this child hasn't been identified? And that's another reason why the police commissioner at the time believed that they were escorts, because he believed they were living off the grid and, you know, not really a part of society.
Mm-hmm. That does make sense, absolutely. We're talking with Bob Kolker. He is the author of Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery, about the Long Island serial killer victims and the Long Island serial killer case itself. Bob, we're getting ready to wrap things up here. Is there something we haven't touched on that we should? Maybe just kind of give us a kind of wrap it all up for us in a neat, nice little bow and tell us what happens next.
Well, I certainly hope that the police know more than what they say they know. Their latest words to the public have been just another plea for more people to come forward with information, which suggests that perhaps they really don't know, that much. I think the opportunity with this book was to keep visibility on this case. I think one of the frustrations of a lot of people who feel very strongly about this case is that even though it's taking place right outside of New York City, and even though it's unsolved and the killer is still on the loose, the fact that these victims somehow aren't ready for prime time, but by some people's standards, has kept the case from being really given the visibility that it needs. And I hope the book does its part to change that, and that I hope it helps people understand why these victims are so vulnerable in the first place. I think one concrete thing we ought to consider as a society is to try to compel police to give immunity to escorts who feel they're in danger.
Yeah.
Or that they're being mistreated by someone. I think there are probably a zillion cases happening right now where a woman is in danger or being harmed by someone and won't go to law enforcement because they think they won't be taken seriously or might even be prosecuted.
Absolutely.
And that's because of the line of work she's in. And you know, I think it's a sad state of affairs that we could sort of deny someone their humanity just because of their choice of work. I mean, as a thought experiment, think about it as a, let's say you were a low-level pot dealer, and let's say somebody was hurting you. I think if you went to the police, you'd probably get some help, at least in some cases. But in this case, you don't. So I want to fight that stigma if I can.
And that's a very good cause to have, because it needs to be done. I think the way that we take care of the people who are down the most really reflects on us as a society. It's really easy to judge, to say, well, that's her fault. She made those choices. Absolutely. But you know what? That doesn't mean you don't treat them like a human being, and it doesn't mean that they're not important. They matter, and they can still have a chance to turn it around. And by God, you have not walked in that person's shoes, so don't be so quick.
And they're someone's daughters and sisters, and it's all just tragic.
I happened
to read on the Wikipedia page about these the Long Island serial killers before the show in preparation, mm-hmm. and there was mention of a few missing people that they are wondering if they are, and the one of them was even, I believe, March of 2013. Do you know anything about that? Are they still thinking this is an active person?
The most recent one appears to be a disturbed person who pulled over and went and tried and took her own life by going into the ocean. That one definitely seems unconnected. And then there were, in early 2012. There were some other discoveries of bodies in other parts of Long Island, and the police were very quick to say that they didn't think they were connected. But, of course, they've changed their theories a couple of times already, so I think it's probably good to keep all of these discoveries in the back of your head moving forward.
Don't you think there's a lot more victims out there? I mean, couldn't the count go quite high, really?
Well, that's happened in other cases. It's a dreadful thing to consider, but certainly you have people who, once they're prosecuted, you remember Ted Bundy, the numbers kept going up and up and up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and I think that's what could happen here, unfortunately, unless he can be stopped. Michael, I'm about to wrap it up. Do you have anything else you'd like to add, my dear?
No, I'm thinking about like a trucker or something. How much action is there on that stretch of highway of like interstate travelers, truckers that could maybe be? Is that
that's been brought up before? That's a good one.
Well, you know, there are. I think trucks are on that highway because you're on your way. You can be servicing some of the more high end parts of Long Island, way out to the east, like Montauk and East Hampton and the Hamptons. It's possible that they'd be no strangers to that highway. It's certainly not a little dirt road. It's a real highway, a divided highway.
And that could be.
People talk Yeah, people talk about truckers. They talk about clamors because there's water on either side of the highway, and you know, maybe someone came in by boat to dispose of the bodies. That's a big theory that's gone up and down Web Sleuths a lot. And then you've got one of the police theories, which is that he is a local who knows the area well, and the reason they believe that is that the remains have been found in this particular spot, and also the Pine Barrens that way out in Manorville, Long Island. And that's a, you know, these are places that only locals would know about.
Robert, tell us your website address, and you've written other things before. Give us just a little bit of a biography here before we wrap it up.
Well, I'm privileged to work for New York Magazine. I've been a writer there for 15 years, and I write cover stories and feature stories that are narratives and often about criminal justice or about, you know, vulnerable people out in society. Lost Girls has a website. It's lostgirlsbook.com. And I have a website, robertkolker.com. That's K-O-L-K-E-R, robertkolker.com. And I have an email address if any of your listeners want to be in touch, including Jan, who called in. I'd love to learn about the Texas State in person. That would be bob@robertkolker.com.
Perfect. K-O-L-K-E-R. Bob, thank you so very, very much. Again, this interview was long overdue, and I do have a link up to the book on Amazon, on Web Sleuths. It's available in Kindle, every which way you want it, they can give it to you. It's Lost Girls, an Unsolved American Mystery. Bob Kolker, thank you very, very much. And we'll be talking again soon, I hope. Hopefully, maybe we'll have a break in the case. Okay.
Yes,
take
you.
Care, Bob.
Thank you,
so much.
Bob. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks,
for humanizing those women. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
It needs to be done. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Michael, I am so glad you called in. I was worried because I know you do get those headaches, and they're not fun. I told everybody I thought it was because you had a Minnesota accent, and it's kind of difficult to talk when you have a Minnesota accent. You take a lot of pressure in your head. You go, Minnesota, and so you always get headaches. I don't know. Anyway, are you feeling better, I hope, my darling?
I still have this damn headache, but it's better than it's been the last couple of days. So.
Good. Well, I'm glad you were able to shake it off and come on the show. And, you know, we're going to be back next week. And next week's guest, well, it's a surprise. Yes, I'm working on it. I think you'll be very, very happy with what we have coming up. Michael, I want you to take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay, it's Trisha's True Crime Radio. Do remember this. A little bit of legal goo again. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com LLC and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get upset, my darling true crime angels, you come to me. You don't blame the forums. You come to me, Trisha, and Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.